draw near to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are American Airlines Employees Federal Credit Union versus Tim Martin from Tarrant County, Douglas and Virginia Lehman versus Harcon Corporation from Harris County, and consolidated with Melvin and Helena Harris versus Harbor Title, both from Harris County, and James Embry, guardian of the estate of Donald L. McNeely and the estate of Donald L. McNeely versus Royal Insurance Company of America and Royal Indemnity Company from Dallas County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete these arguments before the noon break. If you wish to purchase a tape of one of these arguments, you may make application with the State Department. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in American Airlines Federal Credit Union versus Martin.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen L. Baskin, argument
for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. Petitioner contends that the Court of Appeals opinion in this case should be reversed for two reasons. First, that a notice shortening agreement and a depository contract does not require proof of waiver, even if the notice period is less than the 1 year provided under the UCC. And secondly, the Court of Appeals erred in determining that Article 4.406 of the Uniform Commercial Code was inapplicable to this case. This case presents some significance to the credit union industry, as is evidenced by the filing of the amicus briefs. The opinion will have an impact on probably every deposit agreement that's currently in place in the state of Texas for credit union depositors. Petitioner contends that the opinion should not stand as a published opinion in this jurisdiction because it places Texas out of step with the jurisprudence of other states in this country. Also, the opinion is confusing and simply provides poor legal reasoning. It's confusing and it's not proper legal reasoning because the Court of Appeals first concludes that Article 4.406 of the Uniform Commercial Code is inapplicable to the facts of this case. Then it turns to deal with the deposit agreement between the parties, which provided that the customer, Martin, had 60 days to give notice of irregularities in his account. In trying to determine whether Martin was bound by that depository agreement, the Court of Appeals concluded that the deposit agreement was an attempt to waive Martin's statutory one-year right provided under Article 4.406. It was circular reasoning. If Article 4.406 does not apply to this case, which petitioner contends that it does, but if it does not apply, then the parties are simply left with their deposit agreement. And the deposit agreement.
The deposit agreement still refers to an item.
It does.
Okay. And if this oral request for transfer of these funds is considered an item, or whatever it produces is an item, then 4.406 would apply, and then we just go to the question of whether or not the agreement can reduce that period from 1 year down to 6 months.
That would be correct.
But the question is, you talked about being out of step with other cases. Do you have a case that has this kind of situation where there's been an altered signature card and an oral instruction to transfer funds that holds that 4.406 applies in those cases?
No, we've not cited any case. We haven't found any case that exactly the same on the facts.
But our court has Lacerre Grain.
That is correct.
That takes an oral instruction to transfer some funds over a doctored signature card, and this court holds that that is not an unauthorized signature with respect to, I guess, an item.
Yeah, I think, so, I think
How do we get around?
I think Lucera is easy to get around. In Lucera, the underlying fraud in Lucera, as you pointed out, was the manipulation of the signature card. What the customer wanted, it was a corporate account, and the customer wanted any two of four signatories to sign. The wrongdoer manipulated the signature card, crossed out the two, and wrote in one. So the bank was deceived by the fraud in believing that only one authorized signatory could sign. So the underlying fraud in Lucera is the manipulation of the signature card.
Except in Lucera Grain, they said the checks were covered because they were unauthorized signatures for that very reason.
Yeah, the court found that the court in Lucera found that a corporate signature that is unauthorized or signed by a person, one of two authorized signatories, was still an unauthorized signature for purposes of 4406. To contrast the underlying fraud in Lucera in our case, the underlying fraud in our case is the old-fashioned traditional forgery. We do have a forgery in this case. Molly Blair, according to Martin, forged his name on what is called a change card, which is really just a replacement for the original membership application or what in bank parlance would be the signature card. So every time a transaction occurred in this case, the credit union was deceived by an old-fashioned traditional forgery. They believe that Molly Blair was authorized to act in the account because she had deceived them by forging Martin's name on the underlying document.
Isn't that what happened with Sarah Grain? The bank was deceived into thinking only one signature was necessary?
It was deceived, but it was a different kind of deception. It's not. It wasn't a forgery. But I think then the next reason we would distinguish Lucera, in addition to the fact that the underlying fraud is different, is that in this case, each time Blair calls the credit union and gives what is essentially an oral order, it is reduced to writing. There is no evidence in the record in the Lucera case that there was ever any writing created in the one. There's only one telephone transfer, I believe, in Lucera. In our case, each time a transfer was performed, the credit union reduced it to writing and created what we contend is an item. And so on that basis, Lucera is also distinguishable. One of the amicus lawyers reviewed the record in Lucera and represented to this court that the underlying record reflects that there was no writing in Lucera. It was simply
If Lucera cannot be distinguished, is Lucera... Or do you have any commentators that talk about whether or not it's a good law on that point with respect to UCC?
I would argue that Sarah is not of much precedential value here. First of all, it doesn't deal with the fundamental issue in this case, which is a notice provision less than 1 year enforceable? It simply doesn't reach that point. And I don't think you ever, if this court wants to conclude that Sarah compels you to decide that 4406 is inapplicable, you still then have to decide what the contract of the parties in this case was and whether it imposed a 60-day notice requirement.
Except that agreement also refers to the matter being an item. It seems to me the whole issue is there an item that had an unauthorized signature on it that the bank is entitled to require the depositor to notify them about? So
respectfully disagree.
If an oral order doesn't reach the level of being an item, then it would seem that also affects the outcome under the depository agreement.
Well, I guess the credit union would disagree that the deposit agreement is limited to the term item as defined in the UCC. Again, if you're going to apply Article 4 of the UCC and apply the definition of item, then you're going to apply 4406. If you're simply going to review the depository contract as a contract, what it says is that the customer has to report in regard to any item reflected on, and it's how are you going to interpret the word item. The common definition of item would not be the code definition of item. The common definition of item is any piece of information. So I think we find ourselves in circular reasoning. If you're going to apply the definitions of Article 4, then Article 4 applies. If you're going to go outside of Article 4, then you can construe the contract as any other contract, and it is clear from this record that these parties contemplated telephone transfers. One of the amicus briefs recites to the court that there are over 780 million telephone transfers in credit unions per year. The record of this case talks about the telephone center at the credit union where telephone transfers were conducted. Those transfers would only be reflected by the records generated by the credit union in the account statements and in these journal vouchers and sent to the customer. And it's in that context that you should then construe the meaning of the depository agreement. Again, if you're going to apply the definition of item that is applicable under the code, under Article 4, then our Article 4406 applies. Again, I think we find ourselves going in a circle here, which is exactly what the Court of Appeals did. And first, going through the analysis that you're going through, which is no item of unauthorized signature, and then getting to the deposit agreement and trying to determine whether it was enforceable, and concluding that it involved a waiver of a statutory right provided by Article 4406. I don't think we'd have that both ways. So,
Mr. Baskin, can we talk a little bit about the agreement itself?
Yes.
Your argument is that you can agree on the statute to shorten the notice period.
Yes.
Here, did the customer ever, as far as you know, see the deposit agreement?
The record...
He was notified of a change in the terms of the deposit agreement.
The record is that the depositor testified that he never saw it and that he was unaware of it.
But that he continued... Your argument is he continued to... He had agreed initially that he would be subject to any amendments to the deposit agreement.
Yeah. When he signed his membership application, and recall that in credit unions, membership is not available to the world at large. It's only a limited field of membership. So one must apply for membership, and they must fit the membership requirements. Martin did. He was admitted as a member and signed an agreement that said that he would be bound by the then current bylaws, rules, and regulations, and any amended thereafter. That was it.
Would he have any choice, no matter what kind of amendment?
He would not have a choice. If he wanted to be a member of the credit union, he must agree to that.
So you could charge some extraordinary fee and he would not have a choice?
Absolutely not. I mean, all of these rules and regulations are governed by reasonableness, including this, the one we're talking about. The shortening the period of time cannot be manifestly unreasonable. There's always going to be an overlay of reasonableness and compliance with federal regulations, for example, on this credit union. And that's another point I guess we haven't made yet, is that this is a federal credit union regulated by federal regulations and examined and governed by the National Credit Union Administration. So overlaying all of the things the credit union does or cannot do are those regulations.
But there's no regulation that would have prevented you from providing better information to him such that he perhaps would have had a greater probability of learning about the amendment.
Nothing restricted us from doing that. It is our contention that when we amended the depository agreement, we advised the members through a notice in the newsletter, which was sent to all members, and a statement on the account statement itself, which was sent to everyone who had an account, obviously, that there was a new deposit agreement, that it was available in the 30 branches that are around the country and the world. This is a credit union that has a membership population that is always moving. There are pilots and flight attendants and those kind of
things. And it was sent on a single statement, correct?
It was sent on a single statement, according to the record, and in the newsletter, and I'm not one newsletter. It was then available at the branches. Anytime the credit union member visited, you could pick it up at the branch. In fact, the evidence in this case indicates that when Martin stumbled onto the problem in his account, he went and got the deposit agreement at the branch where he works. He works at the FDIC. It was there at the place he works. And also the newsletter said, if you would like a copy of it, call us. So it was available. And our position in that regard is that that form of notification is consistent with that which is provided in the federal regs relating to truth and savings. These are regulations promulgated by the NCUA, and they specifically deal with when there are amendments to truth and savings disclosures, that once there's an existing account, that the new actual text of the disclosure information does not have to be mailed to the member. They can merely be notified of it on a statement or in a newsletter, which is where the idea came from. But the method in which we made available the notice of the deposit agreement was in the context of the federal regulations.
Mr. Baskin, the Court of Appeals seems to have given a very literal reading to item as it's defined in the code. Would you agree with that?
I would not.
You don't think that it requires at all a little bit of flexibility in the definition in order to reach?
Absolutely. In fact,
it does. I mean,
there's a great deal of flexibility. The definition of item, and in the comment, it talks about that the choice of the term item was picked up by the persons who codified the UCC because it was banking language. And it uses, when it talks about it, it talks about paper. There clearly is a suggestion that item requires something in writing. And I think we quote in our brief Professor Hockland, who says the same thing. He, of course, says that there should be a great deal of flexibility of what can be an item. And he even suggests that when you look at the definition of writing in 201 of the code, it says that a writing is any intentional reduction to tangible form. And he says that merely making an entry on the account statement itself, reducing electronic communication or verbal communication to an entry on the statement itself, ought to serve as an item for purposes of 4406.
Do you know how old this provision is?
Which provision?
4406.
Oh, actually.
And also the definitions that we have to look to.
Well, the definitions, I guess, they were codified in the early 60s with the Uniform Commercial Code, I think adopted by Texas in 67. But the context, the underlying rule of 4406, which is a customer has a duty to pay attention to his account, can be traced back to, I think there's a case, Leatherman versus Morgan, 1886 case.
I guess my point is that given the date of these provisions, and I mean, obviously the changes in the banking industry have been huge over the last 30 or 40 years. And so that's why I'm asking, if it seems to me the Court of Appeals gave a very literal reading to the words that are used in the statute, perhaps not looking at the comments, as you're mentioning, but in fact looking at the words as used in the statute. And I'm curious, it seems strange to me that we haven't seen any case law in any other jurisdiction even where this question has been raised. Whereas banking procedures have changed and technology has advanced so that transactions occur in different ways than perhaps they did back in the early 60s, that's why my question to you is this a definition that is flexible in terms of expanding to cover the changes in the banking industry, or are we in some way bound to a more restrictive definition that is more literal as the Court of Appeals?
Well, I think it's very flexible, and that's what the commentators say. And there are cases. There is the Sabatino case that we cite, where the underlying fraud relates to withdrawals from an account, then cashier's checks issued. So what comes back with the account statement is simply the account statement itself showing the withdrawals, but of course the cashier's checks are retained by the bank. And that was a South Carolina case, and the court holds that even though the items don't come back with the statement, that the duty under 4406 was evoked because there was enough information in the statement itself to cause the customer to inquire, and then they could have asked, and then they could have seen the item. So there's a court, that's an example of a court that recognizes that there's all different kinds of fraud and there's all different kinds of ways fraud can occur.
Well, in this instance, then, what, if he had looked at his statements, he would have asked to see the journal entries since they were oral transfers? Is that how the same analysis would work?
Actually, in this case, this case is probably a case which is the other extreme. This credit union sent Mr. Martin 14 different mailings, 12 journal vouchers, each mailed individually to him, and two account statements in a six-month period of time. And it's clear that he wasn't going to read his mail. He simply didn't look at anything we sent him. And so this is not a case that turns on the absence of paper or an attempt to communicate with the customer. I see my time is up.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Kern A. Lewis will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. I'd like to jump directly, if I may, to one of the arguments that Justice Hankinson raised about the definition of item. Whether or not 4406, that one specific provision of the UCC applies, because this is a financial transaction, financial commercial transaction, it's still governed by the UCC. The definition of item is governed by the UCC. And this is their agreement, is to be construed strictly against them. So if they're going to have an agreement and a commercial transaction that to which the UCC governs, the definition of item in the UCC that's elsewhere besides 4406, regardless of whether 4406 applies. An item is defined as an instrument or order for the payment of money. So here's a simple text. We can tell that these journal vouchers are not items and that that argument is ridiculous. Let's take one of these journal vouchers. Let's take it to the credit union, present it to a teller, and say, okay, give me $5,000. This is an order for the payment of $5,000. They're going to tell you very quickly, no, that's not an order for the payment of $5,000. That's a receipt of $5,000 for you to pay. So it doesn't meet the
definition. Do you agree that these oral transfers are very routine with credit unions and that the agreement between depositors and the credit union to allow oral transfers is a very regular provision?
Oral transfers are becoming more regular.
And if that's the case, where are they governed? And under what provisions of the UCC would we look to determine what obligations or duties the depositor has vis-a-vis the transactions that are occurring at the credit union?
I believe, although the trial court judge disagreed with me, I believe that 4A of the UCC, which governs electronic transfers, that would be an oral transfer, applies in that case. And in this case, I specifically, during the trial, I asked their expert witness. I took, and that's cited in my brief, I took the comments from 4A, which electronic funds transfers. There's an example given in number one of the comments. I went over that example with their expert witness, and they admitted that this transaction was exactly like the example given. It didn't involve a wire transfer between two banks. It involved the customer transferring funds in his own bank between two separate accounts. And if this is controlled by 4A, the only penalty for failing to give notice as required by 4A is you don't get interest.
But these funds transfer provisions seem to apply to transactions as between various financial institutions.
Again, the comments to 4A, comment number one, it gives an example, and that example is exactly like this. It's a transaction within a single financial institution from one account to another by a depositor. So I believe the comment applies.
So under this provision, if the provisions of 4A apply, then there is no duty on the part of the depositor to give notice when within a certain period of time if there is some sort of problem with the transaction?
No, Your Honor, there is still a duty. But the
what are the parameters of that duty and where do we find it?
It's in 4A, I believe I cite it in my brief, 4A 20-something. But if you fail to give notice, the only penalty is you cannot recover interest.
But can you give us what the summary of that? Is there a time period?
Yes, I believe it's a one-year time period also. It's in 4A.
And if you don't give notice within that time period, you just can't recover interest, but you get all your money back?
Yes, Your Honor. That's specific. And that brings up the question, the underlying issue that I think the court has to address here, which regardless of whether this is covered by 4406 or 4A. The bottom line is, can a financial institution modify the limitations period in which you have to bring a claim by a provision in their own deposit agreement? Now, in what I consider almost an act of divine guidance and intervention in this case, there's a law review article that came out this month in the Texas Tech Law Review, which I filed and given to the court, because the court's bound copy won't arrive until sometime in February. Professor Shersansky from the University of Houston Law School has written an article entitled Deposit Agreements, A Wall of Protection or a Wall of a False Foundation. That article tracks our position in this case almost exactly and, in fact, argues it much more persuasively than I'm able to do so with much better analysis. And what's very important in that case, I'd like to bring to the court's attention in that article, all of the cases relied on that they say are the other jurisdictional authority that Texas is going to be out of step with. All of those cases trace back to a single case from New York called Parent-Teacher Association. Parent-Teacher Association was the case that said, yes, you can modify these deposit agreement, this time period under 4406 to as short as 14 days. As Professor Shersansky...
Before you go on in terms of talking about this, and obviously we haven't read this since you just gave it to us, but this certainly seems to undercut your position that 4A applies because the provisions that are talked about in connection with this kind of transaction are the ones the petitioner has cited for us.
No, Your Honor, it doesn't undercut 4A because most of the cases involve checks, traditional forgery. Lacerra is the only case that involves an oral transfer. Now, in the Walker case that's cited in my brief, The federal court in Houston reviewed an oral transfer and said 4A does apply. But again, the trial court and the court of appeals disagreed with me. I have to be candid about that, even though I believe it still applies. But going back to the law review article, the parent-teacher association case, what they don't tell you in their brief when they cite it and quote from it extensively is that parent-teacher association was a trial court level opinion. In New York, the trial judge can issue an opinion. Three separate appellate decisions from New York after parent-teacher association by three judge panels decided after parent-teacher refused to follow it and effectively overruled it. Now that's important because the Bassey case, which they also rely on so heavily, relies on parent-teacher association almost exclusively as its authority. And what's also important is that New York does not have a provision of public policy like Texas does that's found in 16.071 of the Civil Practical Remedies Code. That provision expressly states that no contract can impose a condition precedent. They call this a condition precedent four times in their brief. 16.070 says no condition precedent of less than 90 days. Anything less than 90 days is void on its face. Now, they may say, well, it's not really a condition precedent, which I say precedent sometimes. It's not really a condition precedent. It's an effective statute of limitations. And in fact, the PTA case called it a shortened statute of limitations. The Bassey case called it a shortened statute of limitations. Professors White and Summers, in their commentary, calls it a shortened statute of limitations. That raises another problem. The preceding section of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, 16.070, says parties cannot contractually agree to any period of limitations less than 2 years. So, although the legislature can set a one-year statute of limitations under 4406, the parties by agreement may not do so. So the legislature has spoken specifically to that attempt. And that's what Professor Shoshansky discusses. So in other words, the position that the Credit Union Act is asking this court to take is an extremely activist position. They're asking you to sidestep 16.070 and 071. They're asking you to avoid the public policy arguments that are expressed by them. They're asking you to avoid the public policy arguments that are contained in the UCC itself. They're asking you to overrule the Sarah Graham. And I would respectfully assert that the court should not do that. I also...
Let me ask you, does the fact that he asserts that because this is a federal credit union, it's governed by federal regulations, and therefore your argument wouldn't apply?
No, Your Honor. Federal regulations do not supersede state law in this case. There was no pleading or proof in any of the trial court or the court of appeals that these laws were superseded by federal law. And all of the cases involving national banks, for which there's a National Banking Act, as well as credit unions, federal credit unions, that are on the books, none of them. There's not a single case that says state law is supplanted by any federal provision.
That's your position that the three appellate decisions in New York all say that the depository agreement cannot shorten the period of time for notifying the bank?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, the Herzog case, which is mentioned in one of the amicus briefs in a footnote, and which is also discussed in the Law Review article, the Herzog case from New York says that these kind of provisions under New York law are void against public policy because they are effectively a disclaimer of the bank's own negligence. And 4103, which says you can modify the provisions of the UCC by agreement, say, except you cannot disclaim your own negligence. If they're shortening the time period in which you can report one of these things or have a right to recover, they are disclaiming their negligence beyond that time period. And that's the effect. And in fact, Professors White and Summers state in their commentary that a shortened limitations period serves as effectively to enable the bank to escape liability as an outright disclaimer. So this is also void because it's an attempt to disclaim their own negligence. So in that regard, I'd like to address the position that whether this is a duty or a right that's being waived. I think the easy way to look at it is this. Under 4406 or the common law, whether or not it applies, prior to the deposit agreement, if we just look at the statutes without the deposit agreement, Tim Martin has the right to what? He has the right to object to unauthorized transactions on his account from day one to day either 365 or 4 years under a common law thing. He has that right. After the deposit agreement, that's gone. At day 60, it's cut off. So his rights on day 61, 62, all the way through are gone. This is a waiver of a right. And the attempted distinction between a duty and a right is
but if it's but this right, the parties have no relationship until he goes to this and says, I want to have a relationship with the credit union. Credit union says, okay, and that means I'm going to hold your money and I'm going to pay you interest and we'll do all this sort of stuff. And so I agree with them, okay, you can hold this money. Here's our contractual right. Where does the right come in for this member in the credit union other than what's ever in the contract? What other rights outside the contract exist as between the credit union and one of their depositors?
The right to bring an action for damages when that contract is breached. This court has held in Lucero Drain that when they pay an unauthorized transaction, they are breaching the contract.
And so there's some public policy that if you enter into a depository contract with the bank, as a part of the agreement, the parties cannot agree to a term limitation period less than?
I would say 90 days under 16.071, or you could say that the legislature considered this and debated this when they enacted the UCC, and they said 1 year, and anything less than 1 year. It depends on how far the
court
wants to go.
But the UCC is subject to what the other people contract, isn't it?
Except they cannot disclaim the bank's responsibility for its negligence. And when they're shortening that time period, that's what they're doing. They're cutting off their responsibility.
Where in here do you find that parties cannot contract contrary to what may be prescribed in 4406 or whatever?
It's in 16.071 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code and 16.070. The legislature says it's void. They don't say voidable or subject to negotiation. They say it is void as a matter of law.
But they could shorten it to 90 days, couldn't they? Could they shorten it to 90 days?
Under 16.071, it's arguable that they could short it to 90 days if they want to call it a condition precedent. But if it's a shortened statute of limitations, they can't shorten it to less than the one-year period of the legislature. Either way, for the facts of this case, the 60-day attempt is void. Also, I believe that this case is exactly like Lucero Drain. As you noted, it involved an altered signature card. Now, they attempt to distinguish Lucero Drain by saying, wait, in Lucero, there's no indication in the record that the bank had any written record of these oral transfers. Right. I'm sure that this National Bank of Mercedes had no written evidence anywhere of the transactions that had occurred at their bank. And the national bank examiners would be very happy to hear that. That's a ridiculous extrapolation of the facts of Lucero. Of course the bank had a written record, but they didn't go through these mental gymnastics of trying to say that the teller's initials on a transaction made by Blair operate as Martin's signature. That's ridiculous.
If an item can simply be a notation on a statement. The statement comes out and there's a number of transactions listed. If an item includes the notation on that statement, but that's backed up by a written record of a transfer or an order of withdrawal of certain funds to go, that would cover this transaction.
No, Your Honor.
Why would that not cover this transaction?
The item is not the writing on the statement. The item is the underlying written record that's reflected on the statement. The check, the actual check, is the item. Because remember,
why couldn't it be the authority to make an oral withdrawal of funds?
Because the UCC definition of item requires it to be an instrument or order to pay money. And the UCC duty here and the contract duty is to examine your forged signature. There's no forged signature of Martin on any of those things. So you've got to have not only an item, but you've got to have an alteration or a forgery on that item.
So the order to pay has to be in writing. The order itself to pay has to be in writing.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's millions of transactions out there that are not covered by the UCC.
No, Your Honor.
Well, what about an online paying the bill?
Okay. There's an order to pay. It's electronic, but it's in writing electronically. But it's an order to pay. It's not a receipt of a transaction that's already occurred. It's an order. If I go on Quicken on my home computer and pay my bills, by filling out that payment request, I am placing an order to pay that. I am authenticating that order with some kind of PIN code, like, you know, a little PIN number at the ATM. There's no evidence that that happened in any of these cases.
Well, okay, but an oral order, I call on the phone and I'm talking to a human being on the other side and they go check the PIN code.
Right.
Basically the signature card to see if this is a person authorized to make this order. That somehow is not covered by the UCC because it's not in writing. That
no, Your
order
Honor.
Is not in writing.
No, Your Honor. I
but
believe that
electronically 4A, it would be.
4A covers it on as an electronic funds transfer.
But if we disagree with you about 4A applying to this kind of transaction, then there's no place else to look in the code for an oral transaction to be covered. Is that right?
I'm not aware of another place.
If we disagree with you, then these oral transactions that are occurring daily are not covered by the UCC.
No, they're covered by the UCC. They're not covered by 4406. That's what the court held in Lucero.
I understand. But in terms of notice provisions, duties to report, and so on and so forth, we have no other place to look in the UCC if we disagree with you about 4A's applicability.
If 4406, that is the only provision that provides. Therefore, if that doesn't cover it, then there is no notice provision in the UCC. However, whether or not 4406 applies, you know, now these things are all governed by a comparative negligence standard. And that's a modification that's been made. So,
well, if there's no provision on the UCC that governs, why doesn't the deposit agreement then govern?
Well, the deposit agreement would still have to comply with 16.070 and 071, which the legislature says it's void by the notice period being short to less than 90 days at a minimum. If it was more than 90 days, then it might cover. But also, remember, the trial court made a finding. They did not request any additional findings. The trial court made a finding of fact and a conclusion of law that this deposit agreement was vague and ambiguous. And so, and their waiver requires a voluntary relinquishment of a known right. If it's vague and ambiguous, how does Martin know what he's waiving?
Well, we have to decide that there really is a waiver, though, first, before that analysis ever even applies.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the UCC speaks in terms of duty as opposed to right and waiver.
But a duty and a right are the same thing. And let me give an example. You have a right to a jury trial, but you have a duty to pay the jury fee.
Those are two very different things.
Well, my point
is an obligation that you have to do something. You may get a benefit as a result of it or earn a right. Duty and right are not synonymous under the law, are they?
Well, my point is that in reality, duties and rights always correspond with each other. Their attempted distinction is that...
But they're different legal concepts.
Yes, but it's still his right that has been waived, because his right is the right to complain. Not that he's not waiving his duty to examine the statement. That's not what's being waived. What's being waived is his right to recover. And that is a right provided by law, both common law and statute.
Or else he has a duty under the law to do something in order to be able to get his money back. That's another way of looking at it.
Yes, but that's not what's being waived.
Well, that presumes that there's a right being waived. If you
yes,
look
ma'am.
At it from a duty analysis and you read the statute that way, and if he has a duty and he properly exercises his duty, then certain benefits come his way.
Right, but they are conditioning his right to recover, which I don't believe they can do.
Can I go back?
Yes,
Your Honor. I want to get clarification on one point. Okay. It's not your position or isn't your position that any attempt to shorten the notice period constitutes an attempt to limit the measure of damages for it.
Yes, that is my position.
That is your any attempt.
Any attempt to what the legislature debated this and said 1 year. Any attempt to modify that is an attempt to disclaim their own duty of good faith. And that's what the Herzog case in New York concluded when they reviewed this, as well as cases in Ohio, Alabama, and West Virginia have concluded that. And those cases are all discussed in Mr. Ronsky's article. My
Any
time is up.
Questions? Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
discussion, maybe we ought to bring it back to the concept of this 60-day, the 90-day statute under 16.071. It is simply inapplicable, and the way to decide that is fairly easy. 4406 in the Uniform Commercial Code has two defenses. One is called, one is the one we've been dealing with primarily, it's called the absolute notice provision, 1 year. The other defense in that is called the repeater rule. And under the pre-96 code, there was a notice requirement of 14 days, and the defense would have, a defense would be created. That is, the customer had 14 days in order to give notice of problems in his account, and if he failed to do that, if the same wrongdoer continued to act, then the customer was cut off. That was short, that was lengthened to 30 days in January of 96 with the amendments. So what? So I guess what Mr. Lewis is arguing is that the legislature in 4406 and the repeater rule created a notice provision that is inconsistent with 16.071. Well, that's not right, because 16.071, if you trace it back, it's been on the books a long time. The code comes into effect in the early 60s with a 14-day rule. It then is modified in 96. And proper statutory construction is that the later is going to control over the earlier. So the later UCC rule is going to control over the earlier. And more importantly, the specific statute is going to control over the general. Our legislature enacted the Uniform Commercial Code, and it creates the basic law concerning relationships between customers and financial institutions. And they would not draft in a notice provision that is violative of some other statute. And if it is, then the specific statute, the UCC, is going to control over the general.
Let's talk about the definition of an item. Mr. Lewis argues that an oral demand for an oral order to pay is not in writing. And he says item is defined throughout the UCC as being something in writing that's an order to pay.
If this court believes that an oral transfer has got to be reduced to writing in order for Article 4 to apply, then we have that very thing happening. The journal vouchers are the attempt of the teller to write down what they're being told. They have on the bottom of them a blank that says, and it has the word printed on their signature, and they are signed. They are not mere receipts, particularly if you look at them from the perspective of Martin. Money is being taken away from Martin's account and put into Blair's account. Martin didn't receive anything. They are a reduction to tangible form, which is the definition of writing. Any reduction to tangible form is a writing by a person acting on behalf of someone they think is authorized to act in the account. I mean, this case should not turn on whether the old-fashioned forger would rip a check out of the checkbook and forge and send it into the collection process. There you have a piece of paper. This one, the modern forger, calls on the phone because she's already deceived the financial institution by what? An old-fashioned forgery. She sends in a change card and sets up the credit union, believing that she's now authorized to act on the account. And so she perpetrates her fraud by phone, and the tellers write it down. And she knows the tellers are writing it down because on the third transaction, she does it in person. And even in person, when she communicates person to person, the tellers write it down for her. So again, the case should not turn on who writes the item, who prepares the item. And we've given an example. For example, pre-authorized drafts. Pre-authorized draft, your insurance company, you give your insurance company information about what your checking account number is. They send, probably now, it's only electronic, probably not even reduced to paper, communications of various banks that get back to your bank, and the $200 premium, again, no paper, it's all electronic, debits and credits, goes back to the insurance company. And on your statement, under other transactions, they'll be all your pre-authorized drafts. And that goes back to Justice Hankinson's question is, are we not, is there, what law controls those? Well, there are other laws. Electronic funds transfers are computer-to-computer transactions, ATM transactions. Federal regulation controls that. 4A does control wire transfers and some others, but it doesn't control when the flow of instructions comes from the person getting the money. Even if you think this is otherwise a funds transfer, this is what's called a debit transfer. And a debit transfer is one where the instructions come from the person who receives the money as opposed to the person who's sending the money. Classic example would be a wire transfer. You call up the bank and say, wire $1 million to the Bahamas. That's a funds transfer, and it's called a credit transaction. Instruction coming from the person sending the money. So,
any other questions? Thank you,
Thank you.
That concludes the argument, and the first call will take a brief recess.